You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. She has already worn out one pair of hiking boots in recent weeks, and later this hour, we will meet the first person of color and first woman to complete a winter through hike of the Ice Age Trail. And through this lens, we're exploring diversity and representation in outdoor settings. Are you a person of color? What is your connection to the wilderness or the land? Do you live near a park or a green space or have the ability to go into nature? It's 800-642-1234 to talk the nature gap. Carolyn Finney is a cultural geographer. She wrote the book Black Faces, White Spaces, Reimagining the Relations of African Americans to the Great Outdoors. She is a scholar in residence at the Franklin Environmental Center at Middlebury College. Carolyn, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thank you. Glad to be here.
You grew up on an estate in Westchester, New York, where your parents worked as caretakers of the land. Can you tell us about your childhood and what you saw?
Yeah, thank you. I can. So I always tell this story. You know, my parents originally grew up in Floyd, Virginia. They grew up poor. You know, they grew up black, high school education. And after my dad came back from the Korean War, like a lot of black people who lived in the South in the 50s, they decided to move north because they thought, you know, they'd have better job opportunities. This was during Jim Crow segregation. So they moved to New York. And one of the job offers my father got was from a wealthy Jewish family that had a 12-acre estate 30 minutes outside of New York City. They needed full-time caretakers. So my parents took that job. They were the landscape gardeners. My father was also the chauffeur, my mom the sometimes housekeeper, and it's a stunning, stunning estate. The estate had fruit trees, vegetable gardens, a swimming pool, a small pond with fish in it, really stunning woods. And so we grew up there. This was a very wealthy white neighborhood. We were the only family of color in that neighborhood until the 1990s. American woman moved in for a little while, and then she moved out. And when I say very wealthy, I always tell folks Harry Winston had had property down the street. Schaefer of Schaefer Beer lived next door. Winkfoot Golf Club was literally walking distance around the corner. So it was strange. I mean, it was what I tell people is that, you know, it's interesting to reflect when you were a kid, because on one hand, me and my brothers were playing outside all the time. We all learned how to swim by the time we were six or seven. You know, we had to because of water on the property. And it was stunning. It was like having our own private park because the owners often weren't there during the week. They would just come up on the weekends and holidays. But, you know, I also tell the story of when I was nine and being stopped by a policeman, a white policeman in a car. You know, there were always policemen patrolling the area because of all the wealth. And so I was walking home from school. So fourth grade, I went to public school. I was right around the corner and he stopped me and wanted to know where I was going. And I gave him the address and his response to me was, "Oh, so do you work there?" And I remember thinking, I'm nine, like what's happening right now? You know, but what I said was, "No, I live there." I was kind of confused and he let me go. I went home and told my parents. My father called the police station and really gave them a hard time and asked them not to bother me and my brothers again, which they didn't after that. But when I think about a lot of the stories now, when I think about, you know, what was it about me that the policeman thought for some reason I didn't belong there? You know, and the fact was I was a nine-year-old kid. So why wasn't he stop if he was going to stop me and say, do you need help getting home? Do you know where you're going? You know, all those kinds of questions he could have asked, the logics of seeing a little girl at a certain time of day with a school bag. But his response to it was, oh, do you work there? And so I sort of take that into my adult life. The other thing that I want to say is that, you know, the question of, well, not just ownership, but who belongs in these spaces and who gets to claim them. My parents, you know, once it hit the 90s, had been caring for that land full time for nearly 40 years. And when the owners, the patriarch had died many years earlier, but when the matriarch of the family that owned the land knew that she was dying, she had to think about what was going to happen to my parents. And I know she considered trying to keep them on this land that was worth over $3 million, property taxes, $125,000 a year. With my dad making $20,000, $25,000 a year, that wasn't going to work out. So she had a house built for them in Leesburg, Virginia, because at that point, me and my brothers were grown, and my youngest brother had married and had kids and it settled there. And so she had a house built for them. She passed away. The new owner came on. My parents stayed on until 2003, which means they were nearly on the land for nearly 50 years, because there always needs to be somebody caring for it full time. And then in 2003, the new owner found the family from the Dominican Republic. As I understand it, they moved in. My parents moved out. And it was at that point that this got really personal for me, because I watched my father in particular get very depressed about this new owner.
Yeah. Your parents had such a connection there. They had been there for decades.
They've been there for nearly 50 years. Our whole family, you know, when you think about how place and land, tells us a little bit of who we are. But the other thing is that my parents labored on that land. And, you know, sometimes I think when we talk about the environment, particularly in this country, we privilege recreation as the primary way with which we engage. And I'm not downplaying or putting down recreation, but I'm saying that what about all the labor, the care, like the spaces, our public lands, all these spaces, these privately owned spaces, they don't just look that way. I mean, you know, non-human nature is beautiful, but one of the reasons they are accessible to us is because there are people caring for that on a day in and day out basis. My parents knew that land better than anybody else.
Yeah.
They had a high school education, but they could tell you everything about the wildlife on the property, everything, even if trees got fungus, like everything that goes on that property. You know, I have funny stories about my dad and the geese, because the geese drove him crazy on the property. But,
Let me reintroduce you for a moment. Carolyn Finney is the author of Black Faces, White Spaces, Reimagining the Relationship of African Americans to the Great Outdoors. We're discussing access to the outdoors, Carolyn's personal story, and how to make these spaces more inclusive, with your questions as well. 800-642-1234. You know, nature is supposed to be this great equalizer where services are free and universal and accessible. And Carolyn, you just pointed out that someone still has to be the caretaker. They still have to make those spaces, have the ability to use them properly. But, you know, going back to the history of our public lands, you know, rooted in our violent eviction of Native Americans, do you see, tracing all the way back, that is an underlying problem to where we are today in this nature gap, if you will?
That's a great question. I think two things are underlying in terms of the legacy that we all have inherited, even though I don't think we all experience the legacy in the same way. The first is that we stole all the land from indigenous people. Really, I can't put it any more bluntly. But the second is that we enslaved another group of people to work the land for free. Mm. So it's not just one, it is actually both. And to understand the legacy of that, so when you start to get into questions of our environmental history, right, we tell grand narratives of who we are as a country as it relates to the land. The narratives for me aren't wrong, they're just highly incomplete. They're often told in a really universal style. Here's how we all will be. John Muir and Roosevelt made this decision about national parks. We talk about it in a very particular way. You know, at the time Roosevelt and Muir were making these decisions about wilderness and national parks and public lands, and I want to be really clear to the audience, I served on the National Parks Advisory Board for 8 years, so I have great respect for a lot of the work that people who work for the Park Service do, right? So I'm not denigrating the Park Service. But when Roosevelt and Muir were having that conversation, Jim Crow segregation was in place, which meant if you were black or if you were non-white, there were a lot of spaces you couldn't go to. And what's really interesting is that we talk a lot about the restaurants, the movie theaters, the schools, the jobs, right, that people couldn't go to. And somehow we might think that the beaches and the hiking trails and the parks were immune, but they were not. If you were non-white, during that time, there were a lot of those spaces you couldn't go to. And even if there wasn't a sign saying you couldn't, you knew better than to take that risk, right? I mean, you had to at least think about what that meant, whether you were driving while black across the country and had to look at the green book, because, maybe you wanted to go on a family trip to go to a park somewhere, but you had to think about, where can we stay? Where can we stop and use the restroom? Where can we be safe, right?
Yeah.
So that legacy for me carries over into today in a very particular way, which does not deny the adventurous spirit and the courageousness and people taking risks, such as the woman that is hiking the trail right now in Wisconsin.
Well, that's a great way to pause right here with Carolyn Finney, a cultural geographer and author. Do you feel the state and national parks are welcoming to you? How would you make the great outdoors more inclusive? What do you want to ask about being a trail hiker on an extremely challenging journey across Wisconsin as we meet Emily Ford? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about how to make natural spaces like national parks and wilderness areas, trails, more inclusive to communities of color. We have cultural geographer Carolyn Finney as our guide. We're also showcasing the story of Emily Ford of Duluth, Minnesota. She's head gardener of a historic house museum there called Glen Sheen. And this winter, she is doing something no Black woman has ever done before, hiking the Ice Age Trail from beginning to end. She has a 65-pound pack, a sled dog named Diggins at her side. And her challenging journey, now on day 58, has made her a role model on multiple fronts. What inspires you about Emily's journey? Will you walk in her footsteps? Join in at 800-642-1234. Emily, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
Where are we finding you? Where are we reaching you?
Yeah, I'm just outside of Cornell. I'm actually sitting in the middle of the woods right now. And got to start this morning and hiked for about an hour and got a call from you guys, which is awesome. And Diggins is sitting right here. It's really beautiful out. The sun is shining, and we got a little bit of snow last night, so
great. And the temperature is approximately
33.
Yeah, so quite warm compared to what you've been experiencing with snowstorms and sub-freezing temperatures. What made you want to go on this journey?
Yeah, so for the beginnings of it was just I wanted to take a long hike, you know, and I get 3 months off in the winter. I wanted to be home for the holidays, so I stayed home and hopped on this trail. But as things started to approach and get closer and as kind of things started to unfold in Minnesota a little bit and kind of trying to find my spot in the racial justice movement, it kind of turned into equality in spaces, outdoor spaces, and advocating for that a little bit, very quietly, just by doing the thing mostly. And that's kind of what happened. So, I mean, it's just started because I wanted to. I like hiking. I like backpacking. I like the winter. So there you have it.
Emily, who taught you to love to hike or how to pitch a tent or the best way to pack your backpack? Like, who taught you to be an outdoors woman?
Oh, man, a collective of people, really. You know, I spent all of my time. I loved being outside as a kid. I loved being, like, a dirty kid. I hated coming in. My mom would be like, please take a shower. And I'm like, I'm going to get dirty tomorrow anyway. So I love being outdoors like that. I grew up in a suburb of the Twin Cities, and then my grandparents had a farm in northern Minnesota. So I would help out on the farm there, out in the garden and driving the four-wheeler. And there's a family up there that I was really close with, and they took me to the Boundary Waters for the first time in my life when I was at really quite young but very impressionable age. And then I went to college, and actually I switched over to a geology degree in college because I thought it was cool because they did stuff outside. And for like our spring break trips, we camped the whole way. So we would drive to like the Appalachian Mountains or like the Texas, and we'd camp our way through the areas. And then I moved up to Duluth, which is like outdoor central, which is awesome. And my mom bought me my first tent. And I took it, I shoved it in a kayak, and I hiked, I paddled out to a little island on Boulder Lake and spent the night out. And I was like, oh yeah, this is the life. This is cool. And then after that, you know, you just talk to people. You find people who you know, backpack, but also, you know, the great teacher Google and the great teacher YouTube. I, you know, always follow, you know, different people and find different people on social media and stuff. So
Carolyn, what do you think about what Emily is doing now?
Emily, you rock. So yeah, that's what I think. Hello. But I also I want to say that back in when I was in my 20s and 30s, so this is late 80s, early 90s, I spent the better part of 5 years backpacking around the world. I mean, and I would come back home, save money, then Africa for 6 months on my own. And then I did it again. I went back to Africa, then I did it again. But then I went to Nepal, and I ended up living in a village there for a year and a half and doing the trek. So the thing that I, you know, am both thrilled to hear that you're doing is I think about when I was doing that, I never saw anybody who looked like me, ever. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw lots of backpackers from all over the world. And even when I would run into Americans, white Americans abroad, they always thought I wasn't American. I had the backpack and all the gear, and I'd start talking, and I'd be like, dude, I'm from New York, you know? Like, how do you not think I'm American, you know? And I realized there's just so many – part of it is the representation. People were sort of surprised to see me doing the things that all these other young people were doing. So what's unusual about that? So I love hearing that you are doing what you're doing. I feel like without knowing you, this is presumptuous, that there's some of it that I really understand. I would tell people that I would go anywhere by myself in any other part of the world, most other parts of the world, right? And I would often do it by myself. But there are places here I wouldn't do that by myself. Mm. I'm much more reticent about some places in terms of trekking, hiking, you know, outdoors in the United States than I am about, say, going to certain parts of the African continent or going to certain parts in Asia, you know, which is really, I think some of that is psychological and I'm older and I'm not, you know, yeah.
Well, I want to pause here and reintroduce you both. Emily Ford is nearing the end of her through hike along the 1,000-mile-long Ice Age Trail in the winter. Carolyn Finney is author of Black Faces, White Spaces, Reimagining the Relationship of African Americans to the Great Outdoors. And taking your connection, your questions about outdoor spaces and what they evoke for you, 800-642-1234. Emily, when the so-called trail angels offer you along the way a warm bed for a night or a hot meal, I'm wondering what those evenings are like with complete strangers and what the conversations you've had have been like.
Yeah, this is something I absolutely love. I love talking to people I don't know, and hearing their story, really, and kind of removing any assumptions that kind of people may have about Midwesterners, especially in Wisconsin. And so I've been able to hear about, I ask them, like, why they live where they live and how they get there. And I get to hear, you know, I get to hear about their families, things that they're passionate about. A lot of these people are you know, hikers or paddlers or mountain bikers or, you know, whatever themselves. And, you know, and hearing how and why they get involved in the Ice Age Trail. And like, why did you, I like to ask you, like, why did you reach out to me? And why did you, know, like, how did you find yourself desiring to have a stranger in your house? Cause it goes both ways.
Yeah.
You know, we're both strange to each other. And so, yeah, I really love that. I love hearing just the passion behind people's voices. And I've stayed with families. I've stayed with just, you know, single people. I've stayed with couples.
Is it hard to say goodbye in the morning when you know you'll never see or talk to this person again?
Some people, yes. Oh, yeah. Yep. It's, I just, like, think about them all day, and I'm like, oh, man. Dang. You know, and the thing is, you know, I work, you know, in a public place so people can come visit me. But that is definitely a hard part is when you're a traveler like this, I like to akin it to speed dating, which I've never done before, but I'm guessing it's similar. You kind of like make a connection and you have to move on.
Yeah.
You know, you leave your heart in little places, but, you leave little pieces of your heart in places, But you can't leave your whole self.
You have to just keep moving, keep forging ahead. I would imagine that is a real mental challenge.
Yes, especially when it's cold out and their houses are so warm.
And the meal is so good.
And the meal is so good and it's endless. Yeah, yep.
We're talking with Emily Ford, who is making history trekking the Ice Age Trail in winter from Pottawatomie State Park on the shores of Lake Michigan to the St. Croix River at the Minnesota border. Carolyn Finney is a cultural geographer and environmental affairs scholar and resident at Middlebury College. How can national parks and wilderness areas build relationships with diverse communities? When you explore natural areas, do you see people like you on the trails or out on the water? How could the outdoors be more inclusive? Be part of this conversation, 800-642-1234. We'll talk more. Be back after a news update here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and we're talking about identity, race, and representation in natural spaces. Think state parks, campsites, trails, wilderness areas. We're looking at this issue through the story of Emily Ford of Duluth, Minnesota. Emily is a Black woman who is hiking the Ice Age Trail now, a 1,000-mile trek. She's making history. Do you see yourself in Emily doing something when there is no one who looks like you doing it? What practical questions do you have about hiking the Ice Age Trail in winter, by the way? It's 800-642-1234. Emily stays with us, and so does Carolyn Finney, a cultural geographer and environmental affairs scholar and resident at Middlebury College. Carolyn, let's talk a little bit more about the 80s and 90s. You had been backpacking, you know, around the world, but you felt afraid to backpack alone in many parts of the U.S. Can you talk more about that fear?
Yeah, I think I can. And I don't want people to think that I didn't feel some trepidation every time I got on a plane to go somewhere else around the world, too. I felt that. But there was something about my own experience growing up and being a Black woman and having my skin called out in various circumstances throughout my life, actually, regardless of where I live, that the idea that I would go to somewhere here in the United States to hike alone on a trail just didn't feel appealing. I don't know how else to say it. It was just a little too scary for me to think about what that would look like in terms of being outdoors. And, you know, Emily seems really like she's got her stuff down, like she's doing the tent, the whole nine yards. I've done some of the tent camping. I've definitely carried my backpack for weeks on end. But usually in other countries, it's also a little bit easier where there are places you can stay really inexpensively, you know, by our standards and by my own privilege going over there. I could spend a few dollars and get a bed, you know, and bunk with a lot of other people in a space while out on a trail. And that was something in the 80s and 90s I didn't hear about or see about or, you know, I couldn't figure out how I would map that. You know, what would it mean? Would I have to be out in the woods by myself for days on end? Like Emily, I love meeting people I don't know. I also, you know, form interesting relationships. The same thing happened when, you know, there were people that, you know, some I would keep in touch with for a little while after we had met somewhere out in the world and come back again. But it was harder for me to think about how I would do that here. I just didn't find it. I mean, this is a terrible thing for me to say, but I just didn't find it attractive, like attractive in the sense of it wasn't calling to me to be here. Now, as an older person, I travel a lot in this country, but I don't go backpacking in this country, which is, there's a lot of reasons for that, mostly because I'm too busy because I'm working all the time. But the other piece of that is when I started traveling in to see the national parks as a member of the National Parks Advisory Board, you know, I had a better understanding. I started to get a better understanding of the public spaces. And maybe if I was younger, you know, if I was 20, 30 years younger, I might say, okay, maybe I'll consider the Appalachian Trail or the Pacific Coast Trail or, you know, any of those big trails here. But I don't know. I mean, last summer before the pandemic, I was off to Iceland to attend because I wanted to do some hiking in Iceland. So that's out my head. And I ended up not being able to go because of the pandemic. But it doesn't, I don't have the same thought to do it here.
In the U.S.
Yeah.
Well, Emily, you know, Emily, you've said that you hope your trek inspires others, particularly Black women, to get outdoors and have their own adventures. Do you see these outdoor recreational spaces as being dominated by white people and unwelcoming to people of color?
That's, I think that, you know, I was scrolling through Instagram a while ago, and somebody had posted that if you think that Black people aren't outside, maybe your social feed is just a mirror of yourself.
Hmm.
And, for people who aren't of color. So I think they are, you know, still majoritarily white spaces that are now being reclaimed by everybody else. And I, you know, for this trip especially, I was talking to James Mills a while ago now, and I was like, you know, it just takes, you know, one person at a time doing the thing to make other people feel more comfortable. And so that's kind of what I hope, you know, with this. So, yes, I mean, when I go out, I still don't see, you know, I've seen one person of color on this trip so far, and I've hiked 900 miles. It's also the middle of winter, so I haven't really seen many people, period. But back home, it's kind of the same thing. And I hope that just people feel like they can do it. Is, you know, to your question, is it unwelcoming? You know, I'm the only scientist I could claim to be is a geologist. I'm not really a human scientist at all. But these are just kind of my observations of sometimes I think it's unintentionally unwelcoming, and we're learning how to be intentional with each other and be kind to each other. And that takes a lot of work.
Yeah.
And so I'm hoping that over time we won't have to use the language of unwelcoming. Do I think that there's some spaces that are just unwelcoming? I mean, yeah, but you kind of find that everywhere, you know.
Yeah. I'm wondering, you have a lot of time to think and reflect as you put one foot in front of the other each day. What have you learned about yourself and the world in the past, 58 days?
Yeah, that's, I don't know if I've processed everything quite yet. Oh, there's so much time to think. I mean, I do a whole, 9-10 hours of just walking and thinking. The world, what I've learned about the world is, when people can be gathered behind one, when people can be united behind one good cause, people become exceptional and very kind. And it's kind of a part of humanity that I don't think we really talk about or see, because it's not always newsworthy. Again, not everybody's perfect. There's definitely spaces and people that, I'm sure I don't really want to encounter, but so far so good. And what I've learned about myself is probably so many things. I'm eager to get home, but I am learning how to teach myself how to rest on this trip as well. There's something called a zero day for people. It's where you don't hike any miles, and I'm not very good at taking zero days, and so I've had to really kind of force myself into it on these on this trail, to be kind to myself. You know, being kind to others sometimes comes easier to me than being kind to myself. So I think that learning how to do that has been the greatest thing I've learned so far.
Oh, those zero days and trying to take that over to life after this hike. Carolyn, there is time and space in nature to think and reflect, but that too is a privilege. What do you make of things learned like zero days and things like that?
Emily was talking and I'm nodding vigorously, but you can't see me because I'm like, Emily, we've got a lot in common, I'm just going to say, because it's easier for me to give other people the time they need than to give myself, right? Who's the hardest that we're, person that we're hard on, and I know who that is for me. I think that is right on point. Something else that Emily said about intention is something that I talk about too all the time. What is our intention in everything that we do, and how do we pay attention to that intention, right? So we can serve that in a very particular way. So I think you know, the 0 days, taking a moment not only to reflect and take time to breathe and to exhale, but also rest, you know, rest so that we can show up for the long game. You know, what does it mean for us to be able to find that rest? And yes, to your question of privilege, yes, I think in many cases it is a privilege. My parents, you know, it was hard for them to do that because, you know, that 24/7 they had to be at the call of the owners who worked that land, and that's what they did. And they had three kids to care for, and people who've got multiple jobs or are major caretakers. I mean, you know, I think that we confuse the rest with relaxation and recreation. And so I think that rest, you know, it's something that we might even train ourselves to take a couple of minutes here and there. Sometimes, you know, we get in the car and before we turn the key and take off to where we're going, we take a moment. If sometimes right before we go to sleep, you know, if it's possible to find a moment. And these days, COVID, for those of us who live with other people, you know, I live alone. So, you know, the challenge is of where do you find that space? But we get very creative and innovative about that. And we do that, right? Not just because we think we're all that as individuals, but we do that so that we're able to show up for the people and the causes that Emily was mentioning. You know, how do we show up for these things? Yeah. How do we show up as our best self for these things? What is it worth it to ourselves to make sure, you know, if you were training for something, if you were training for any kind of athletic, you know, event, you're training a lot, right? Yeah. You have to train a lot, but also you have to rest your muscles. There's a balance in there that you have to figure out what it is so you don't injure yourself. So what does it mean for us to think of rest differently, you know, as something that, you know, allows us to be the better persons that many of us want to be?
Emily, there, speaking of showing up, there's a 3-year-old Alaskan Husky who is showing up for you day in and day out. Can you tell us about Diggins?
Yeah, she definitely is. Yeah, I kind of, the other day I had this thought, we were hiking and I'm just like, you know, I'm in charge of taking care of her on this trip, but I mean, she has been taking care of me in ways that, you know, I didn't even imagine. So yeah, so she's a 3-year-old Alaskan Husky. She is in front of me all day long. She were literally attached to each other all day long. Mm-hmm. And we sleep in the tent together. And I'm super thankful. You know, I tell people, you don't have to have a dog to do long trips like this. There's plenty of people who that do solo trips, you know, without any companion at all. But she has made this trip such a delight. She's funny to me. I think her personality is funny now. We kind of exchange looks now that we've been together for so many days. And
what look does she give you when you sing to her?
She likes it when I sing. Like, she'll point her ears back towards me. But like sometimes like at lunchtime, I'll turn on my phone and like have just a small dance party. And she doesn't like the phone as much. She doesn't like when my phone makes like song sounds, but she likes it when I sing. So she just keeps on trekking forward. And sometimes I'll just call her name and she'll like look back at me like, what do you want? I've got a job to do here.
Well, Emily, before we let you get back on the trail, I'm wondering, how do you change the narrative? How do you bring about more diversity in outdoor spaces?
Yeah, I think just like what Carolyn was saying, and she meshed what I think she meshed our thoughts together really well, of just like paying attention to your intentions,
mm-hmm.
watching the language you use, like with your own privilege, like how much access do you have to the outdoors with not only distance to a trail, but the actual time, the amount of time that you have, right? So like I have a partner, but we don't have any kids, you know, so I can just, you know, leave and, you know, they'll take care of the house and whatever. So I have that type of privilege where I can just kind of, you know, go and leave. Not everybody has that. So doing that. And then, like I said, it just like, if all of us do just a little bit, a lot gets done.
Mm.
And I don't think that, because when stuff with George Floyd came out and like all this stuff, I'm like, I don't know where my spot is in being helpful. And I just like saw all these people doing such amazing and huge, big things. Not to say that this trip isn't huge. It's very long and it's a big thing. But to me, this is just my passion, right? So I love backpacking. And so it doesn't feel like the weight is so big. So finding your passion and showing up and just even if you just do a little bit, then that little spark inspires others to just do a little bit. And so on and so forth. And it's easy for things to catch a blaze with little sparks. You know, so that's probably how I would.
That's very, very uplifting, Emily. Carolyn, before Emily gets back to the trek, is there any last words you can leave her with?
Emily, I wish I could meet you on the trail. Emily knows what she's doing. She's got Diggins. I want to ask you if you've never read Tracks by Robin Davidson. That is my favorite book of all time. And Robin Davidson in the 70s crossed Australia with three camels and her dog. It's a fabulous story. So I just want to put that out there. There's nothing I need to say to you. You already know what you're doing. And I want you to be well, continue. I hope when you come back, you've got lots of stories to tell. And I can't wait to hear some of those stories. And I'd love to meet you someday. So that's, and I know James Mills, he's a brother from another mother. So we're going to have a conversation when you get back.
Emily, you take care. Thank you for joining us, taking the time.
Yeah, have a good one.
You too. Emily Ford of Duluth, hiking the 1,200-mile Ice Age Trail, about to become the first Black woman to thru-hike in the winter. Author Carolyn Finney stays with us, cultural geographer, scholar, and resident at Middlebury College in Vermont. You can join in. What inspires you to get outdoors? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about how to begin breaking down gender and race barriers in the outdoors and why outdoor spaces lack diversity. According to a study from the Center for American Progress last summer, it's called The Nature Gap, communities of color are three times more likely than white communities to live in nature-deprived places. That means less or no access at all to parks, paths, green spaces. Carolyn Finney wrote the book Black Faces, White Spaces. She's a scholar in resident at Middlebury College, and she's with us for about 9 more minutes. We heard from Ryan in Superior, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Ryan has worked with African Americans on building trails for AmeriCorps. And Ryan wants to know what more can be done to encourage people from all walks of life to get involved in projects like this.
This great question, Ryan. Well, so I also spend a lot of time working with often predominantly white environmental nonprofits, government agencies, institutions, organizations, botanical gardens, et cetera. And so a lot of times when I talk to organizations that are saying, how can we engage more folks of color and get them more interested? The first thing I do is, and I mean this very gently and kindly, is to check the assumptions. That you know, sometimes we think they're not engaged when they've been engaged all along. They're just not engaged in the way that we measure and count. So in the way that my parents worked somebody's land this year, they were outdoors all the time. They could tell you all about the land. They're not considered environmentalists, though, right? They're not actually raised. When I lived in South Florida in 2005 for a year, I was doing research down there, and I would spend some time in the Everglades National Park as well as Biscayne National Park, which are about an hour away from Miami. And at the time, the staff at Everglades National Park, which was predominantly white, would say that we're trying to get more, you know, African-American and Latinx families to come out to Everglades. We don't see a lot of them here. And part of the problem was transportation because, you know, there was no public transportation at the time. You'd have to have a car. But there were those who would then jump to the conclusion that Black and brown people don't care as much about the environment. And I said, you know, I drive around South Florida all the time, and the Everglades as a place actually spreads beyond the park boundaries. There are canals everywhere. And every day you see Black and brown people fishing on the canal. So they're out there every day. And I would say to them, I said, you know, I see Black and brown people up there fishing. kitchen every day. And one person actually said to me, oh, yeah, but that doesn't count.
Mm.
Now, you know, and I don't think they were being glib. I think they were just, you know, that what they were inferring is it doesn't count in the way that we measure and think about recreation and we think about engaging with the outdoors. So part of it is in reframing that. I always tell people, instead of thinking of it as sort of a linear, you know, we've got to outreach to people, we've got to bring them in to do this thing. Outreach, actually, it's, there's good intention behind that, but that's unequal power relations, because outreach usually means I can bring somebody in to what it is I'm doing. They have to learn everything it is about what I'm doing around my table, but I don't actually have to learn anything about them. So nothing about the way that I do anything changes. Only the person being brought in is the one who has to do all the changing. So what if we thought instead about relationships and relationships of reciprocity as a web, you know, have we ever asked people what they're interested in? You know, and I want to be really clear about this. No matter what the color of your skin is, not everybody likes camping, hiking, you know, being in the outdoors. And that's perfectly fine. It doesn't mean you can't care about the natural environment and understand that as a human being, you need it to survive. Yeah. It doesn't mean you can't participate in a variety of ways. So I think it's also opening up what we privilege as, you know, the ideal relationship for human beings to have with non-human nature.
You know, you look at this lack of diversity in the outdoors doesn't equal a lack of interest among people of color. One thing I want to ask you before we have to go, how has the pandemic and the inequalities of the pandemic affected our relationship with nature and who has access to nature?
It's a big question. Like Emily, a lot of this is what I'm thinking about all the time and writing about, so I'm still processing a lot of it. I do think that it's focused, for some of us, the attention has shifted a little bit to what can we do. You know, the pandemic in many ways has shut down a lot of avenues that we had to engage with each other, right? We know it's not as easy now, depending on where you live in the country, to go out to a restaurant or hang out with your friends or invite a lot of people over. But with the weather, if you can take the weather wherever, I live in Burlington, so a lot like Wisconsin, it's cold here and snow, but you know, you can go outside. And so I think it's provided for some people a more expanded avenue of taking time, more opportunities to take time to be in the outdoors. But that's not actually what I really want to say. What I really want to say is, I think that the pandemic's not by itself, but it's about the pandemic. It is about, we are suddenly having a conversation about systemic racism at a deeper level than I have ever remembered in my lifetime that we're having in this country. And also the question of, you know, the political divisions that we're seeing that have always been there. I think all those three things have come together in a very particular way for all of us to question what is most important, do we value?
Carolyn, right? Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Carolyn Finney, storyteller, author, cultural geographer, wrote the book Black Faces, White Spaces at Middlebury College. Earlier, we talked with Emily Ford, hiking the entire Ice Age Trail. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.